Okay. All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, we might get a start, I think. I'd just like to start by saying welcome to everybody to the first CREEP Forum for the year on supporting research. My name's Gary Pearce. I'm from RMIT University Library. Today's forum is, as I said, on supporting research, and as you can see in your program, you know, the research agenda has been around for a number of years now, and well long enough for us to reflect on it a little bit and look at some practical experiences. There's a bit of a focus in today's seminar on surveying research needs as well as those kind of practical experiences. You'll see from the program that there's three broad themes: what researchers need, research support, and the ANZ project. Within each of the sections today, we'll have papers followed by questions, although, as Jenny has said, if someone has a burning question after any particular paper, please stick up your hand and we can have the speaker address that. That sound that you just heard at the front is the sound from our official timekeeper. So we have a bit of a packed agenda today. There's more speakers than usual, so everybody will be speaking for about 15 minutes. That sound will ring at the 13-minute mark, I think, and also the 15-minute mark, just so you know how you're going for time. We've structured around the usual kind of structure for these things. We'll cover two of the areas before we break for afternoon tea. There'll be half an hour for afternoon tea, and we'll come back to the last area on the ANZ project, followed by a tour of the Footscray Park Campus Library. The only other thing to say in terms of preliminaries is the toilets are outside. Just keep going that way to your left, and they're around the corner. Okay, so let's start with our first speaker and our first theme, which is about what researchers need. Our first speaker is Dr. Lyle Winton. Not quite. Dr. Lyle Winton is the Associate Director of e-research at Victoria University. Lyle is working with the Office for Research, IT Services and the Library to develop e-research capability across VU. And he's speaking today. The title of his talk is Victoria University's Recent Data Management Survey, Its Implications for e-research Training, Some Early Thoughts. Thanks, Lyle.
So I'm new to CREEG, so if this talk is totally inappropriate, and I hope you'll stop me halfway through. What I thought I'd talk about first is probably e-research. Now, I gather half of you have actually probably come across the term e-research, at least. How many people here have? Yeah, probably most of you, right? But it's always good to get a bit of a perspective on what it's done, I guess. In some terms, most people recognise technology as both a tool and a hassle. It's annoying in our everyday lives. And I've broken this list of sorts of things that we talk about in e-research into two sides. These are the kind of things that we deal with every day that are kind of a hassle but we have to do. Over here we've got some things that are probably closer to toys. So researchers would love these sorts of things. I want to have high performance computing. I'd like to have a new tablet, those kinds of things. But I think the sort of e-research that is the most fun, I guess, or the most interesting, is where you actually start to work with people who are technology savvy or technologists in order to actually do research projects. And that's the sort of thing I was involved in a former role with the Victorian E-Research Strategic Initiative. I've been lucky enough to try and start a few of those sort of projects here, which I won't talk about at length. Now, this is a slide maybe a few of you have seen before. I put this together with Anne Border, who's the director of the Victorian E-Research Strategic Initiative. This is basically a summary of about 5 or 6 years worth of e-research projects that we've actually done in an attempt to try and map out what actually is a kind of a mud map, I guess, of e-research. Now, the boxes in red are effectively the kinds of things that researchers have asked for. Many of them would like community or project management space, a kind of a online collaboration environment, perhaps. Lots of them like to share resources, including documents and data. And quite a number of them actually want custom services built, and that might be something around a database. That could actually be tools in terms of high-performance computing or remote access to something. And there's an awful lot of actual projects that are done with service providers, to some extent, to try and give remote access to instruments or laboratories or facilities, and that's another big activity in any research. And those are diverse, and things like the Australian Synchrotron, for example, or high-performance computing facilities. Now, in order to do that, there's a bunch of other things that you need to do that researchers aren't aware of, including identity management. You need hosting infrastructure for the IT. You need things like RNET at the bottom level, and you need digital storage. And eventually, you need to be able to keep things somewhere because you have records of the project. Now, the reason why I put this up, I think there's several reasons. The first is, if you're an IT person, then this is the start of an IT architecture that you can build to support research. Now, looking at it from a research perspective, I think increasingly you will see that these sorts of things are creeping into research projects across the board. And we start to call these things virtual laboratories. The laboratory is now becoming more digital, more virtual. The wonderful benefits of that are that all of these things are cheaper, generally speaking, than actually building a building in a physical lab, and they're far more accessible because all of these things are on the internet, so you can actually collaborate with people around the world easier than you could before. Now, another way of looking at this is how the researcher themselves look at this. Now, I think we want to get to the point where researchers start to consider this their architecture for their project. Maybe not all of it, but bits of it. I care more about data, perhaps, those sorts of things. And when we do that, I think there's a few problems involved there. One of which is, I think we need to make a point that it's not actually just about data. You'll hear frequently from people in the e-research community, it's all about data and that's it. It's actually also about what you do with data and how you collaborate around data and how you collaborate in general. And the other point is that the federal government has actually provided a very large amount of investment, and the state government to some extent as well, in a whole range of projects that some of you will be aware of, and infrastructure providers and expertise providers to try to support these kinds of activities in this map. Now, if you're a researcher, putting this together is not trivial. Actually understanding who can help you put it together or who to get access to is also not trivial. So there is a need there for people in the space to be able to be aware of these networks and to understand how to piece these things together so a researcher can get to the point from I don't know what I want to this is my infrastructure, this is my architecture. That's just a point I'd like to make. Now, some general observations. I presented this at eResearch Australasia at the end of last year. You're seeing increasingly enterprise storage for researchers and online collaboration environments from the previous slide. There's an increasing use or awareness of external facilities, and we're starting to see some researchers using those things. But here are the sorts of things researchers have been asking for. These are anecdotal, right? Researchers want to know, how do I simplify my life? They don't want to know all those things on the previous slide. Where can I put my data and my materials? Very simple question. So physical stuff too, not just digital. Much to my shock, not really. So where do I keep things in the long term? Because I know I have to, and that's quite difficult. And many researchers start to have questions about their institutional data policies, or perhaps the Australian Code, mostly about their institutional policy. And questions about ethics and privacy and security, lots of concerns about that sort of thing in the digital world. Now, we undertook a survey. The first survey was not undertaken when I was at Victoria University, but Jenny Cameron over there was involved. And we undertook another survey in 2011 that was based on adversity in an intersex survey, but also there was strong overlaps between those surveys so that we could understand trends, if you like, within the researchers' needs. We managed to get a 20% response rate, which was a fabulous response rate, I think, and a fairly even distribution of people across the board in research. We have quite a lot of higher degree research students, so it was good. And I have to say that, you know, the results have not yet been released because we're still kind of working on it. But I'll give you a bit of an early look at some of the interesting points that I think we've been able to pick out. And I'll just point out that many of these results do need checking. So in use of information communication and technology tools, we're seeing that a lot of our researchers are using software and databases for various purposes. Our researchers are, however, in terms of collaboration, doing an awful lot of collaboration internationally and across Australia. But the use of what you would traditionally call collaboration tools, video conferencing, web collaboration tools and file sharing is actually fairly low, which we thought was quite interesting. Now, the use of traditional methods for collaboration, face-to-face, email and phone, are quite high. Now, I'm not quite sure if this is that they don't know how to use the digital tools, or actually it might be that they're quite smart. In fact, that if you're trying to communicate with a community that doesn't have those tools or doesn't have the time to engage with those tools, perhaps the nursing community, perhaps councils or western suburbs communities, then maybe that's a limitation, got nothing to do with technology. Now, 31% of people said they would like to have more support in technology tools, and these are the sorts of things they wanted support in order of priority. Many of them statistics, although we actually do have a lot of support for statistics, so it's an awareness problem. Qualitative tools, I believe that's the same for that as well. Many of them would like to know how to do transcription of audio tapes and video. And quite a lot of them actually said, I don't know what it is I want help in, but I want help. And to a lesser extent, some people in some geospatial tools. Now, we got a very similar response from collaboration technologies. And in that, they mostly said they wanted help with collaboration environments in general, in video conferencing, sharing tools, and to a lesser extent, training. So only a small fraction of those people said they wanted training. So we looked at what data was out there. The majority of it for VU is in documents, reports and spreadsheets. Although there was an interesting response there in 28% websites. I'm not sure what that means, Jenny. We have to look into that. Don't know how you collect data into a website, unless it's a survey, perhaps. Now, on the traditional big e-science side of things, you'd expect computers and instruments to generate a lot of data and a lot of video data, but there actually isn't that much at VU, which is interesting. More than 26% of them said that they had mostly non-digital data, and more than 59% of them said they actually have some non-digital data. So we're living in a world that is both digital and physical. We have to remember that. 48% of them had said that they considered digitising but had not done it yet. So I think there's a potential there for a service to actually help recommend digitisation. In terms of requirements in managing their data and themes that they had come up with in terms of concerns, most of them had said that they understood their requirements and talked about security, confidentiality, linking and coding data, which I think is a wonderful response. 60% of them felt that they could actually meet those requirements. 20 of them felt that they definitely couldn't. And the rest were probably unsure. Now, in terms of size of digital data, this is going to vary across universities, I gather, greatly. 80% of our respondents said that most of their data was less than 100 gigabytes. And in 2009, 80% of our respondents said that it was less than 10 gigabytes. So you could interpret that in one of two ways, that there has been, within a three-year period, a jump, or it was a two-year period, isn't it now? Sorry, a jump of a factor of 10, which could be quite scary. Or perhaps people are actually more aware of their data now. That's a potential. But what this actually means for VU is that if you multiply that up by the number of researchers and students that we have, it's actually not that hard to store 80% of the data at the university. So a very large amount of our data resides in the long tail. Now, having talked, I at first had thought this was something that was special to VU, but having talked to University of Queensland, it's not. In fact, I think most universities have a vast amount of data that is quite small in their research. Now, more than 60% of people said that they back up, which is fabulous. However, most people, even though we have enterprise research storage, we still just advertising it though, use their own hard drive or USB or external disks. Now, an interesting point is that 83% of people are happy with that, which means that if we're trying to get that culture to change to move to better storage or centralized storage, that's actually going to be a tough sell for us, I think. So that's a bit interesting. When we asked people, do they have a formal data management plan? 76% said no, or not sure, which probably means no. When we talked to people about how they provided access to their data, so sharing and reuse, 48% of them said that they would allow it via privately negotiated access, which is really good. But not very many of them actually said, you know, they deposit it within a repository, I guess. So that could be an awareness problem. Limiting factors that most people said were about they felt that they weren't allowed to actually share their data. We actually do a lot of contract-based research, and I think ethics is possibly a concern there. Many people felt that time was the second most limiting factor to actually sharing their data, and fewer people actually said that the issue was about technology, which is interesting. We also shoved in an Anne's question about the Australian National Data Service, and interestingly, 54% of people said that they were interested in knowing how you could cite their data and put it in a national registry. So that's a lot of facts and figures, I guess. So here's just some thoughts, I think, and it's still in the early days on thinking about training. What we definitely know is that there is a need for awareness from those facts. There is some need for support in those facts, and there is a need to improve, particularly on the research data management side of things. So we could actually have levels of approach towards this. Training and workshops are one level that we've done before, but that's actually not for everyone. And I think the survey indicated that most people, that wasn't the mechanism of support that they actually wanted. We could create online materials, and I know other universities, such as Monash, have had quite a lot of success with that. Across from that, we could actually probably, I think, leverage social networks. One of the responses to the questions was about who do you receive most of your IT support from? And by far the largest result was my colleagues. It was the people who I sat next to. I think the library and ITS were actually up there fairly high, but it was mostly my colleagues. So we could actually consider using that as a strategy and say, okay, there are support staff out there sitting next to researchers. They're already connected to researchers. How do we improve their abilities to improve awareness of the services that are out there, to increase their level of ability to support the services that are out there, and even to actually sit down with researchers and maybe improve their practice, perhaps? I think that's a question that we're asking ourselves here at the moment. And we've been influenced a bit by some of what, I've forgotten her name now, it's a lady from UQ. Belinda Weaver had actually presented at eResearch Australasia last year about professional development for library staff, and I think that this is something that we're very interested in. So in awareness, we've actually been talking to our research ambassadors, a bunch of students that do support for research and research students. And we've given them some suggestions. Here are a couple of icebreakers. Where do you back up your data to? If the answer is no, then you can lead on to different questions. How secure is your data? Because we feel that our research storage is actually far more secure than what they would have on their desktop or their USB sticks. And the big question for retention, actually reuse to some extent, is about where are you going to put your data after the project is finished? Because you have to keep it around 4 or 5 plus years. How do you use that data for promoting the work that you've done? I'll leave you with one more point, and that is that I think that we need to tread a bit of a fine line between being experts and empowering people. Now, the Digital Curation Centre from the UK have actually come out with quite a lot of advice on preservation of research data. And in projects in the past that I've been involved in, the Australian Partnership for Sustainable Repositories, we come out with quite a lot of advice as well. Now, these sorts of things are too complicated for researchers to deal with, and too complicated for even e-research directors like myself to deal with sometimes. So we need to keep it simple, I think. Do you need to keep the data or not? Is it valuable? Is it a record of what it is that you've done for proving integrity? How and where do you actually keep it? Those kinds of questions. And that's it. Thank you.
Okay, our next speaker is Chris Evans. Chris has been the science librarian at the University of Tasmania since 2004. Currently, as well as being a branch librarian and a liaison librarian, Chris has a library-wide role in leading support for researchers at UTAS. And the title of Chris's talk is Getting Researchers to Speak, the Effectiveness of a Broad, Blunt Instrument. Maybe we should stand back a bit.
Is it? I don't know.
Hello.
I just thought I've turned it down slightly. Okay. Is that still recording? Is that still quite clear? Might even be better to be even lower. That's still okay? Is there less echo? Good.
A very simple agenda today, what we did, why we did it, how we did it, and that's probably where it gets a little bit more complex and where I'd like to share some of our experiences with you, and would we do it again? Always a good question to ask oneself. But what we actually did was a survey of all of our UTAS researchers for 4 weeks over October and November 2011. We asked 20 questions via SurveyMonkey. Everyone knows about that tool. We sent out a bulk email via our DVC research and co-jointly with our university librarian, which I think was a good tactic. And we sent it out to all academic researchers and all higher degree researchers. And through the course of the 4 weeks, we really ramped up our promotion. Actually, it was centralised through me for probably a slightly ethical thing. We didn't want liaison librarians to run off and say to someone, have you done the survey? We wanted everyone to be getting the same message more or less at the same time. So we used things like our graduate research newsletter, UTAS weekly bulletin, emails to associate deans and graduate research coordinators, and of course things like library blogs and library web pages. Why did we do a survey? Well, I almost don't need to state that, I don't think. I think you're probably all in the same space in one way or another. So clearly the context was changing scholarly communication and probably, you know, at least Australia-wide, if not internationally, an increased emphasis on research impact within the university sector. At UTAS, we had a recent paper asserting the strategic priority of improving research performance at UTAS. So it seemed like a good time to ensure that we were on track. So our simple goals really were to make sure or to find out to what degree our current programs and services were supporting researchers' needs and to identify any gaps in those services and to ascertain if specific cohorts of researchers had particular needs in relation to the library. I think the survey also appealed as a way of seeking an evidence base to the service provision that we had already. We all were feeling as liaison librarians fairly overloaded, you know, and wait, there's more we have to do. So how were we going to manage what we took out and what we kept in? And we were really looking to researchers to tell us that rather than making assumptions. The landscape was that there were some big surveys coming out internationally through OCLC and RIN, and there were a few surveys that had been done within Australia, but not a whole lot from what we could gather through Dalliance. I know University of Ballarat, Ms. Donna here? No. Had done one And there was a call one, I think group of eight one, but we weren't really privy to the results of that. But it seemed like a good idea. So the tool selection, it was all about, well, in the end, a broad, blunt tool, not a violent tendency at all, but how could we really get an overview, a broad sweep of what researchers wanted? We wanted to, I suppose, invite a range of perspectives and identify broad trends. We considered other options, such as focus groups, and certainly I was advised by a quantitative scientist when consulting with him that focus groups would be a really good way to go. You have a few questions, you have, you know, people very well prepared before they ask the questions, etc., and you go in and do that. Now, that didn't appeal because I think we were really wanting the broad view. And we wanted to give every individual a chance to speak for themselves. You know, it was a voluntary survey. They were encouraged to do it, but, you know, that was really the level of enforcement. We kept our options open for running focus groups post-survey, and, in fact, you know, I don't know when I'll finally say that the research inquiry has finished, because I still feel that's an option, you know, nearly 12 months on, and we may get to that at some point. Liaison librarians, of course, were one source of finding out what researchers needed, but really our current processes were fairly ad hoc, not coordinated. We were perhaps communicating in different ways and getting different communications back. So, again, the survey idea offered a single point of communication and collection. Another appeal of doing a survey was that it would position us well for comparative data in the future. And again, you know, through Lyle's survey, we see that, you know, already they're comparing 2009 with 2011. And no matter what type of survey you do, I think it's nice to have something which has a quantitative element in it, if you like, that you can really look at the variation in the graphs as you know, they change over years. There was also, I suppose, an aside, there was a strategic advantage that I felt would come by doing a survey, because we were writing down and perhaps popping into some of these researchers' minds what the library actually does offer for them. We weren't telling them precisely, necessarily. We were more, you know, giving them... Well, we were. We weren't telling them what we could do. We thought that was best left to them to tell us what they needed. But it was a way of communicating what we do already. And, in fact, as I go on, you'll hear that was where the most surprises really were. So the question choice was the next challenge. And really, when I started, I thought it would be fairly easy to, you know, we know what we want to know, don't we? But if you ask a colleague, they may have a different question they want to know. So our questions were influenced, informed, added, dropped, modified so many times through a process of consultation, fairly wide consultation. Some of that was with peers, colleagues, some of it with really experienced survey administrators, I suppose, and, as I mentioned, a quantitative scientist, and we asked academics to do some pre-testing as well and some higher degree candidates. So each of those individuals and consultations influenced the final form of the questions. Of course, we had to avoid the usual traps, and I'm sure I could ask some of you what these traps are. First of all, the survey was looking like it was going to be too long, and how do you keep people's interest? And, you know, you're taking their time. How do you ensure that their time is well spent, making sure that every question is really worth answering? There was a temptation to survey researchers about absolutely everything. And here today already, I'm hearing, oh, why didn't we ask them about that? But you can't do it. You have to, I think, have different surveys for different purposes. So ours was all about our services and are they meeting your needs? Is there anything else you need? So we had to really keep coming back to that. Of course, one of the traps, I think, of doing surveys is subconscious bias, leading people to a particular response, making assumptions, and certainly to do some experiences with question logic were interesting. I tried not to actually build in any formal question logic, but sometimes one question followed another, which sort of almost invalidated it to start with. So if you had already said you don't really know your liaison librarian, then how can you rate how helpful they are? So things like that we sometimes still slipped up in the end. Certainly there was also a challenge with ambiguity. We all know about library jargon. I spoke to the executive officer to the DVCR and went through the survey with her, and when we got to a question all about how you use library collections, she said, so what sorts of collections do you have? you know, like, do you have entomology collections? Or, and, no, books and journals. And she said, oh, I would never think of describing, you know, what you have on your shelves as collections. So maybe that was just an individual response, but nonetheless it was alarming, and I thought, right, I've got to make sure I've got enough description in there to be meaningful. Syntactical errors as well, easy to make, and questions not lending themselves to meaningful analysis. So again, through consultations, people would say, well, why do you need to know that? What my favourite question, and I think the favourite question for a lot of liaison librarians, was about if we don't have something in our UTAS library collections, how do you normally try and get it? Something along those lines. And we had a whole range of options. Do you ask, you know, a person in the next office? Do you have a contact at ANU, etc.? And someone said, but what are you going to do with the information? I said, we just want to know, but we're really interested in how they're using formal and informal networks to get these things. And she said, but, you know, it, so anyway, I dropped it, I changed it. You know, we had a variation on that, but just not that level of detail. So it was largely a qualitative survey. We really wanted to give researchers a chance to speak honestly, to not be exposed in terms of ignorance of, you know, skill or knowledge. And so we really, really worked hard to get the wording right, I suppose. There were a lot of open-ended questions. 15 out of our 20 questions had some capacity for extended written responses. So giving the researchers a chance to speak, finding out what was important to them, and not trying to preempt what they might actually want to tell us. The themes of the questions were the adequacy and accessibility of library collections, books and journals, right, for research activities, researchers' use of bibliographic management software, researchers' information-seeking behaviours, their familiarity with and use of services and support provided by liaison librarians, and other support that they needed. I've mentioned the pre-testing a bit in terms of all our wide consultation, and we did get a lot of feedback there on ambiguities, length, relevance, etc., and continued to tweak it until it was time to get it out there. The other bit of pre-testing, it wasn't really pre-testing but it was preparation, was doing an ethics approval. And this was something that was probably completely unnecessary, but I didn't know until we started looking into it whether it would be necessary or not. And I certainly didn't want to, you know, get the survey out there and suddenly be told to, you know, quick, withdraw it, there was something controversial or problematic. So we were really erring on the side of caution. And the other thing that really appealed to me, and I kept, I suppose, justifying the whole survey to our university librarian to some extent, was that I was trying to emulate the experience of a researcher. So if we want to really understand what researchers might need, why not try and make this little research project, do an ethics approval, etc., and see what we can come up with. So with the analysis, I'm not going to tell you about this, and you probably all want to know what the findings were, but it was really the process that I wanted to communicate. We did gain about 400 responses, 434 partial responses, and heard from, therefore, about 18% of our UTAS researchers, and that was split fairly well between higher degree candidates and academic researchers. We didn't go into it at all looking for statistical significance, and again, we were after that broad, blunt overview. What were the broad trends? What were the key things that we needed to hear? The way that we looked at the data, and I don't think this will ever be finished, really, was I made a case to get InVivo. I don't know how many of you are using InVivo, but certainly, again, it was a statistical program that I'd heard of through supporting researchers and was keen to know what it could do for me. And certainly for the qualitative data, it was a way of drilling down, getting that granularity for the open-ended responses. But my skills were limited. They were, you know, learning on the job, and it was very time-consuming. It can generate some really good reports and things, and I'm sticking with it at least for the next 12 months to see how much more I can learn from it. Of course, SurveyMonkey has its own filtering and crosstab response analysis that it offers, and that is really pretty good for what I was trying to do. And Excel, of course, I had a lovely time making graphs and, you know, fiddling with data and getting different percentages out of that. We've reported the survey in two ways. There was a detailed report that I did initially, which I was advised was a perfect internal report. Okay, and so I then did a subsequent report, which was, I hope, a perfect report for our external audience, which was really communicating for them the key emerging themes. And they were no surprise to us. The first one, at least, was collection inadequacies. We were very aware of that, and it was a great way for us to be able to show that there were people who were prepared to write that down. The other key theme was we really need to promote better what we do already. There was no great demand for anything different. There were some things that we will work on and offer and collaborate to offer, but it was really they don't know about half the stuff that we offer. Our visibility is not nearly as good as we expected or thought it was going to be. I was also surprised that people were tending to buy books more than asking the library to buy books. That was a really strong trend that, I just buy my own now, which I thought was a bit of a concern, but maybe we all do that. I probably do it myself. But it is something that came as a bit of a surprise. The other thing that came as a surprise, we asked a couple of questions broadly related to open access and data management, not in any depth whatsoever, but there was not a huge shift towards that, I didn't feel, in terms of that's where researchers were seeing the library anyway, or that's where they were themselves, needing to know more about it, and that's where our services need to be with them. So would we do it again? Well, it was a big commitment, not to be taken lightly. I started scoping the survey in mid-July and finished in about, finished by about March, I suppose, in terms of the second report. The thing is, we did it to the best of our ability. It was a really earnest approach to get the questions right, to use the time of the researchers well and with respect for their busyness. It was also a professional development opportunity, and therefore, yes, I mean, I'd love to do it again. There's so much to learn by doing. And the findings, of course, are really informative, and we're picking up our responses to those through our research support committee in the library, through our operational plan this year. So that really is what I was wanting to tell you. You're welcome to ask me detail about how we did it, what the questions were. I have copies of my survey reports with me, but you can certainly email me for copies of those as well, or for any discussion if some of you are just embarking on your own surveys. Thanks.
Okay, so we have put 10 minutes aside for questions from to either of our two speakers. So, sorry, maybe I'll invite the speakers back up the front.
So has it had an impact, or is it likely to have an impact on the way we now collect? We haven't looked into it, to be honest. We are still in the appeal stage for more library funding for acquisitions. I think that's our first out of fault. I think the other part of that, though, is that it may be appropriate, it may be just the way that researchers now want to operate. They buy their own books. But I think we need to tell them more about how we can support them by buying collections. And I don't think we necessarily make it terribly easy for them at the moment. You know, we often don't know our budgets or tell them budgets till the middle of the year. We need to get our internal processes, I think, much more supportive of building collections rather than a stop-start thing that happens at the moment. So I think part of it is that, yes, we may need to look in the future about a change to putting emphasis on books for research, but I think it's early days, and I think we've got more promotion of what we do and how we do it that needs to happen first. Yeah, you've sort of hit the nail on the head, really, because we did, although it was a library survey, we collaborated intentionally with Graduate Research and with the DVC's office to check that the questions were okay. While I was setting up this survey, we also had the opportunity to buy into a survey of the research supervisors and research candidates. So we popped a couple of questions in there, and I was then shown data from the previous year's surveys of those groups, where there were volunteered responses related to library. So there is some sort of low-level collaboration happening there in terms of, you know, at least communication. The other thing was that when we were asking researchers, was there anything else they needed to support their research? That was not a library question. And we got a huge list of things that they would like support with. Often it's to do with software or how to write a thesis or how to manage a large Word document, how to get promoted through repositories and things. So those sorts of responses did come, and we purposely left the question very broad and open so it wasn't just library. But of course, being a library survey, we may still have biased it so that that was their headspace and they didn't dare say things beyond that context.
I think that comment was about supporting use of services, I guess. But in terms of collaborations, I mean, I think my experience and many people's experience in research is that collaborations happen over coffee and food and alcohol, basically. So not technology. The technology comes later. So you have to know that you use that. And that actually has funny implications for, you know, you have to be able to send your researchers to conferences, basically. Technology doesn't make that cheaper to form collaborations. But in terms of, I think my comment was actually more about the uptake and awareness. We, I think, also had a number of questions that said, I'd like more support on something that we already support very well, in fact. So I think it's just an awareness. That first level is, hey, did you know that we do this? And usually I am reluctant to go through the umpteen pages of the ITS website to try and find details about how to do something. I'll walk into my next door neighbour and ask them or ask somebody over coffee in preference, because it's just faster, basically. So I think we need to try and figure out how we can leverage that, and I think libraries are a fabulous way to do that, because you already have like liaison people, you already have campus people, or even in some universities and circumstances, people who are actually within schools and departments. So those social presences are already there. Now, also within the e-research sphere, I mean, I was asked a question when I first got here, what's the best way in order to actually get a message about uptake of technology and research out there? And my response was not one that was really appreciated, I don't think. I said that the answer is one-to-one. You go out and you meet with people one-on-one, and that, to date, has actually been the best way to actually get uptake, which doesn't sound very efficient, actually. It sounds like if you come to a forum and then tell everybody at once what e-research is, then it'll work. And I think it's a very similar kind of situation, actually. That, yeah. That answer the question?
I'd say for UTAS Library, certainly the trend is away from supporting software. We do support EndNote and will continue to do so in the foreseeable future. And we do make training opportunities available, I suppose, but I think we're going much more down the path of let's collaborate with another area. We can communicate the need. We can support a session. We can cushion it in other sessions, not cushion it, but, you know, fit it with other sessions that are also part of the picture and part of the package, but other areas hopefully will do that training. But it's been a real gap at UTAS, that whole managing your thesis, managing large Word documents. But there is now a graduate certificate in research which is picking up and providing some of those skills for students generally, and we're involved in that already. So I think through collaboration we're picking it up perhaps more than owning it. I don't feel it is an ownership thing for us now.
If I can answer just quickly, I think the question's actually for people out there, not me, because I'm... but I don't think that there's a drop-off, actually. I think one of the things that has changed is that people's skills in general in various technologies have actually increased. So I actually think that maybe the need for where the training is may have actually moved. It's a personal feeling anyway, and I'm not really sure if we've necessarily always understood where that common need or where the most need can necessarily be, I guess. And that's a tricky thing in research, because research isn't a coherent community that all use the same thing, particularly in things like statistics packages or those sorts of things. And I think, you know, I mean, I know that Jenny actually helps researchers with the use of a lot of social tools and a lot of free kind of cloud-based tools. And that is a fast-moving area. So, you know, and sometimes people will probably come along that know more about how to use some of those things than we do, yeah? So, yeah. It's a challenge. So.
Okay, so our next section is about research support, and our first speaker is Jenny Cameron. Let's see here. Jenny is the research librarian at Victoria University, which involves a university-wide coordination of library training and support for researchers, including coordination of the research. I'm going to speak about the research ambassadors at Victoria.
Thank you, Gary. That last question was actually, I think, a really good segue into what I'm about to talk about, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment. There is so much I could cover in describing this program, which was introduced last year. I'm you know, aware of the time pressure, so I'll try and sort of just stick to the more interesting parts of it. But this is kind of the order in which I'm going to cover things. But just a first thing about what is the Research Ambassador Program at Victoria University. The program is designed to provide peer support to students and staff. So research students, masters by research, PhD, and very recently we've opened that up to include honours students, but also research staff. So they're very happy to see whoever we advertise heavily to student and staff cohorts in a range of skill areas. And the connection with that final question is that it actually provides a lovely bridge between the library and some of those other skills, because we've recruited research ambassadors for having skills in Word, in document formatting, in Envivo, in SPSS, and so things that I would never have wanted to get my head around or try and organise training are things that we can rely on the research ambassadors, and we've recruited specifically for that purpose. So there's a whole range of areas that, you know, it's not just traditional library sort of things that these research ambassadors are doing. So how did it all start? It was actually based on a concept at Edith Cowan University. Our director of our postgraduate research office had a colleague at Edith Cowan and had learned about the service that they'd started there that they called SOAR Ambassadors, and that's been going for about 3 years. And To do a bit of background research, myself and the Director of Postgrad Research Office actually flew to Perth and about a year ago to learn all about the program, and that was absolutely invaluable. It really informed. It sort of helped us avoid a lot of the mistakes that we might have made in getting it set up. And I spent 2 days there just sort of grilling the coordinator, met some of the ambassador team and just, you know, asked 1,000 questions, and she was generous enough to share a lot of her documentation, so that was fantastic. Having our Director of Office of Postgrad Research raise it with senior library management, it became a joint initiative between the library, the Postgraduate Research Office, and the Office for Research. I think that really benefited by having the three parties involved right from the outset. And we established a steering committee to oversee the implementation of it, and I was sort of put in charge of the project. We situated the program at two library campuses, so it's situated within the library in various spaces, and two last year, it's actually expanded to four this year, and it was supervised by myself as research librarian. The purpose of the Research Ambassador Program, very broadly, is to assist all researchers, the students and staff, in building research capability in that whole range of areas. They very much serve a role of contributing to the development of the research culture, and that's something that we really encourage in the ambassadors themselves, in thinking about the conversations they have with people and the connections that they can make and the things that people don't know that they don't know, that it really, I think, is having a great impact. They're also there as transition support, so particularly for new higher degree research students, that the research ambassadors can be that person that they just go and have a chat to. No questions too small, no need is too simple. And so we really encourage that. So to provide transition support for the new students. It also has the purpose of increasing employability skills. So definitely employability skills of the actual ambassadors, but it's also intended to be broader than that, in that them assisting others with skills that might be a little bit outside of what they had thought that they needed and doing their research at Victoria University. So we started the recruitment just on a year ago, advertised two PhD and Masters by Research. We actually set the criteria of must have candidature approval, which meant that they could have been in their first year but sort of just near the end of that. However, those that we shortlisted for interview, we did tend to prefer those who were more advanced in their research degree, but not exclusively, because I think we've actually had two recruitment rounds now. The one a year ago, we interviewed 10 and selected 6. We actually had, I think there was something like 24 applications for the one a year ago for the 6 positions. This year we had 27 applications for only 3 positions. So we selected people based on a mix of skills. So we couldn't just necessarily recruit based on what you would consider to be the top 6. Out of the 10, there was a few where we were juggling and saying, well, they're from this faculty, but they bring this skill set, so maybe we'll appoint this one over that one. So when it came down to it, if we'd selected, sort of given everything else being equal, we did make some judgments based on making sure we had someone with in vivo skills, someone with good word and writing skills. So that was a key to the program working. We started the actual program in 2011, in August 2011, and it was run as a pilot up until December. For this year, we did have some delays in restarting, which were unfortunate but unavoidable. So it's actually only just got off the ground. We recruited a little bit earlier in the year, but it only started about a month ago. We recruited 3 new ambassadors, and 3 of last year's continued on. And it was actually really great that happened that way. We had said to the 6 last year that there was the possibility of a 6-month extension. And we'd learnt this from the Edith Cowan group, that they'd said it's handy to keep... We want it as a program that gives new students, continually offers new opportunities, but also we need to keep a bit of the expertise. So to have 3 continue was fantastic, to be able to recruit 3 more. So that was really good. We put a lot of effort into training at the start. We had a sort of a full-day induction, which included inviting various people in from Office for Research. Lyle was heavily involved in the induction with both cohorts, Office for Postgraduate Research, and also learning support staff. So we involved all of those in the induction day, because learning support run writing workshops and provide writing support. So we needed to position the ambassadors within that. You know, when do they refer? When are they actually the ones giving the support? And also at the start, I sat down with each ambassador, identified what their training needs, and encouraged them in a whole range of ways to meet those needs. There are training workshops at Victoria University that the Office for Postgraduate Research offer, and that is things like In Vivo, SPSS. The library offers EndNote training and things around where to publish, managing chaos, which is where I put those sort of Web 2 tools into, as well as data management and storage. So encourage them to attend as many as possible of those sorts of programs. And really, the ongoing professional development is the key to this program working. And so far, all the participants, all of the ambassadors have been so enthusiastic in increasing their skills. Just in terms of what their training needs were, it was mainly around things like EndNote, In Vivo, and library resources. And that was actually something that they really enjoyed. Most of the research students had some knowledge within their own discipline, but they really enjoyed... We sort of teed up appointments with different liaison faculty librarians, and they enjoyed learning about the databases in the areas that are beyond their areas. So that was a really valuable thing that they reported back to us. Communicating within the team and with clients was a very big part of this. At the beginning, getting the IT issues sorted was a huge thing. We had to get laptops. We had laptops for the 2 different sites, getting all the right programs on them, getting the right programs so that when different individuals logged into the laptops, they actually could see those programs so that they could be providing support. I'm talking about things like In Vivo and some of the more unique statistical software that some of our researchers use. And also telephones. There was just a lot of effort in, say, the first 4 weeks of the program getting them. They're actually employed as staff, so they have staff IDs, staff emails as well as student IDs. That actually became important in terms of the way they can communicate with researchers. But first, I'll mention first the SharePoint website that we developed, and that became the core of the team communication. Within SharePoint, we had a team discussion which encouraged the ambassadors to post to on anything, and sometimes I'd fire off a question and encourage them to all give a response. Also, every shift they do, they write a shift report, and that is and every ambassador is encouraged to read that. At the start of every shift, they read the previous previous week's shift reports. So they communicate, and I was delighted from day one how much they shared with each other about what they were doing within each shift. I'd said to them, keep names out of it, like don't be too specific in terms of, but they would actually say, helped a student with this, and this is what we did, and this is how I solved the problem. And they contributed all of that within their SharePoint team shift report. Also within SharePoint, we had the consultation calendar, which had the benefit of it drove the bookings for consultations. It was also the statistics. And so if they had a drop-in consult, they would just log that after the event. Otherwise, they would use it to make bookings ahead of time. The last part of the SharePoint that was really important was the team documents. and they actually contributed to creating a lot of documents to work with in the team. 2 minutes, okay. Office Communicator was something that the ambassadors had never seen before because it's not available to students, but we use it as staff across the university, and they just thought that was fantastic, and communicate with each other. Because they're at several campuses, they actually sometimes overlap their shifts, but from remote areas. They check in with each other in just about every shift and have a chat, whether it's through video or through just the chat service. So, and it was Office Communicator is the way that I communicate with them. I'll be sitting at my desk and a little thing will pop up. They'll say, "Hi, Jenny, you there?" And they'll ask me a question. So it made supervision from remote areas really easy. So the team building side of it, I've really encouraged the strong collaboration, and that has been fantastic. I've already mentioned the shift report and the team discussion posts. I just want to re-emphasise that the teamwork has been fantastic. The students actually voted. I did some end of year work with them and last year they voted the team support as the highlight of the Research Ambassador experience. And used words like it was invaluable, it was priceless. So they were fabulous. In terms of just the mechanics of what they do, each ambassador works 2 4-hour shifts. Last year they were located at 2 campuses, so we were a little bit more intensive, had sort of all day at this Footscray Park campus and one shift over 4 days at the city campus. We've spread a bit more thinly this year over 4 campuses, but what we've done with the roster is worked it out so that between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. there is an ambassador somewhere in the system, that if a student wants to communicate with Skype or email, that they'll get a response during those times. The end. No, it's not. And the other part of when they're on roster, if they're not actually busy, they're encouraged to work on either their own professional development or in creating resources. And last year they created several online guides and lots of team documents that they could share with each other so that someone in the science field knew what a candidature proposal looked like in the social sciences. They were sharing those kinds of documents. The marketing of this has been a huge thing and ongoing. We created an online guide, which is what you're seeing on the screen there. They actually did most of this work. Lots of emails, and we keep doing that. To the research student list, I often will create an email, and sometimes by suggestion from the ambassador, around, you know, do you need help with Invivo? Do you need help with Turnitin or something like that? So very targeted and tailored to their needs. And we did lots of activities last year encouraging them to come and meet with the research ambassador. These slides will be available to you later, but I guess just as an absolute raw thing, the 88% of last year's clients were students, 12% were staff. Some of those staff were actually probably staff who were also PhD students, and they might have been seeing them in that context. We had an uneven spread from the faculties, and that is still ongoing. We've done an analysis of just the last month's worth of consultations, and it's not quite sure what's going on there, and we're discussing that as a group. They're very keen to try and work out, you know, maybe health, engineering and science just don't have as many needs as they do in, say, business and law and in arts. So not sure what's going on there. In terms of the queries, top query, end note, research design and methodology, and that's a big area that they have great strengths in. The final things I'll say, the consultation spaces, these differ across the 4 sites, and it works best when it's a dedicated researcher space. For those of you that go on a tour after this forum, you'll be hopefully shown the research student lounge up on our level 4 of the library, and this is where the ambassadors sit, and it's a fabulous space because there's already researchers coming and going, and it's a bit harder to sort of where they're in a separate space that research students don't normally go to. So that's something we still need to work out. Lots of evaluation collected, the beginning, the middle, the end. In terms of the ambassadors, some fabulous things that they got out of it, particularly that exposure to other disciplines from their peers and through helping other students and saying that it's broadened their vision. And I love that bottom quote, enabled me to approach my own research assignment from multiple angles. Evaluation from the client, we had feedback forms for consultations. We designed a survey to be filled in by users and non-users. We held that up because of the delay in the program restarting, so that's something that I've learned a bit today from this talk about surveys as to how I might modify that slightly. It's been a very positive feedback. I guess, as you'll expect, we're servicing and we're putting in a service where there wasn't one. So on the whole, people are really, really happy about it. And we just keep on asking what next, look for new marketing angles to get the message out. We've attempted to use social media, but it's kind of the Skype aspect. They're not really... we advertise a Skype address, but we're not getting many people responding to that. And Facebook, hard to build up likes on a page, all those sort of things. This is my final slide. Sorry, I've gone over time. Maybe questions after the next speaker? Or... Yeah.
Next speaker is Bernie Lingham. Bernie is the manager at Deakin University Library with responsibilities that span services to the Faculty of Science and Technology, library operations at the Waterfront Campus, and support for researchers. Bernie works closely with the leadership team of two specialist research librarians. In turn working with cross-campus team of liaison librarians and research support officers in providing advocacy and educative programs to support researchers in developing, delivering and evaluating targeted library research services. And Bernie's going to talk about library research support officers aligning research support and services to meet researchers' needs.
Open my PowerPoint, I won't be a moment. It's yours, Barry. I think I picked up there. Get the right one. Okay. It's 2009. Just to recall that year. Those of us that are Cats fans were ecstatic because, yes, we won the AFL Grand Final. But it's not the AFL we're thinking about. It's the research landscape of 2009. At that time, there were government reports that were out, the Bradley and the Cutler reports. We were talking about innovation. There was a lot more funding for universities, but it came with its own ties based on research performance. ERA trial was underway, but the real thing was scheduled for early 2010. It was going to provide an opportunity for an evidence base for measuring research performance and a framework in the future for negotiating research targets. Research quality and metric analysis was all the go and still is. We learnt a lot about H indices. Is that the correct term rather than an H index? Is it an indice if there's more than one? Citation data, ERA ranking journals and so on. There was fierce competition, and still is, between the universities, between higher ed institutions for dollars, for researchers, for students. What we couldn't build ourselves, we bought in. And it was also a time when there was a lot of talk about the research data commons. We were looking at an environment where storage and long-term curation was expected to be in institutionally supported stores. Deakin had strong research aspirations, like many universities. Our DVCR, Deputy Vice Chancellor for Research, believed that we were on a slower growth trajectory than we needed to be, and there were lots of research targets that were set, and acceleration was considered to be what we needed to do. A lot of strategies were established. We wanted to develop a distinctive research profile. We wanted to make sure that we broadened our collaborations nationally and internationally. We were looking at developing a strong research culture, building our HDR profile and so on. It was essential for the library to support what was considered to be a step change in research, and we needed to do it quickly. We needed to think about what services were required. We needed to make sure that they were customised to support the needs of our researchers and to match against what Deakin Hope would be its strategic priorities, its distinctive portfolio of research. We wanted to make sure that our services were based on a strong understanding of subject and discipline processes, information-seeking behaviour and so on. And we wanted to make sure that we had an opportunity to embed within research communities. This is an attempt at a diagram for you of an interconnected network of support that we provide from our research team, our liaison librarians, and our digital services team, who are responsible for Deakin Research Online, our research repository. I mean, pretty much what we wanted to do was really to build specialist research expertise. We introduced a number of new roles. Our two specialist research librarians, and one is in the audience today, Josipa Cernik, who's based at our Warren Ponds campus. Our research librarians and management team, we are responsible for coordination of the service for high-level negotiation with senior universities, senior academics and researchers at the university. And we work closely with liaison librarians and our digital services team. But in 2009, early 2010, we introduced additional new roles of research support officers. And we have one of those staff members with us today, Yi Qing, just to cross over here. Our research support officers are currently enrolled or recently completed, higher degree by research students at the university. They are part-time contractual positions, and at the moment we have about five of them. They're based at both our Burwood campus and our Warren Ponds campus, but they meet the needs of students across our four campuses. So we've got another campus, as you know, two in Geelong and one at Warrnambool. They work under the direction of Linda and Josipa, the research librarians, and they certainly contribute to an in-depth understanding of research processes and researchers' needs because they are researchers themselves. And they allow us to strengthen connections with researchers and research teams. Their roles? The first part of their role is pretty much peer support and training, as Jenny referred to before, in terms of providing that support between one HDR and another. Their position objective is really about providing training and support. They do so less in a one-to-one situation and more in relation to group training. We provide a lot of mentoring and support to HDR students through group training, so they play a key role in delivering a training program which we've negotiated with our central area of support at the university, Deakin Research, and in particular the Institute for Research Training, who's charged with providing research training for HDR students. We provide a regular program of training on a quarterly basis at the moment. In the last couple of years it's been more on a monthly basis, which meets the needs of on- and off-campus students. Their achievements are in delivering the library workshop for HDR students. You can see the number of workshops that have been listed there on the screen. I should just note that the participants may not be individuals. Someone may actually have attended more than one workshop. They work closely with the research librarians and the liaison librarians in providing this training program. They support faculty outreach. In particular, this is done through our Librarian in Residence service. That service is one which embeds liaison librarians and research support officers in the faculties and research centres. And wherever possible, a research support officer accompanies a liaison librarian to Librarian in Residence service. It occurs at different levels of service for different faculties, so it might be once per week for one faculty, or it might be several times per week, but the service occurs at all of our campus libraries. It's very valued by staff, and I've just included a comment there from Thomas, who is one of our former research support officers, who noted in particular that it was getting to the point where, in fact, they didn't have to go out there to try and see whether there were students around that they needed to support. Supervisors were ensuring that their students made contact with the liaison librarians and research support officers through that service. They also support our data reports that we provide in terms of bibliometric support for researchers. We do try and provide training, advice and resources to help researchers to create their own data reports and to develop their own expertise in bibliometrics. But we understand that some of our researchers, they're more than capable of doing so on their own. There are others who require a higher level of support. So we're working in particular with the Faculty of Business and Law and Arts and Education to provide more targeted support to grant applicants in particular. That's the focus of the service. So we're providing a reporting service for those who put forward a formal intention to submit a grant application. And while some of that is still a little ad hoc, we're working with the faculties to create a more streamlined process and consistent process of support. So our research support officers do a lot of the work in gathering the data and forming it into an initial report. They also help us to meet government requirements for research reporting. In particular, they provide support in relation to Deakin Research Online, our research repository. Deakin Research Online supports both ERA and HERTSI reporting. So they successfully helped researchers and research teams in ERA preparations for both 2010 and 2012. And it's mainly in terms of assisting researchers to understand about processes for self-submission and to just raise awareness about the research repository and its role, and also to talk about issues like open access. And this year, the DRO was quite successful in winning a VC's award for outstanding contribution to academic support. And both Yiching and Barry, who'll be talking later from Deakin, were part of the team members who received that award. They will do so shortly. Okay, so the benefit for the research support officers, they have built relationships. They've helped us to strengthen our relationship with the faculties. They work well in a team, and Jenny referred to that about the research ambassadors, the way that they interact well with each other. Our research support officers have an opportunity to work locally with each other and across the teams. They work with students and researchers not only in their own research teams, but obviously in a broader range of staff. And they have quite a lot to do with the liaison librarians and with a wider range of library staff, including our frontline services staff, who are the staff who work mainly at our service points. Not only have they developed their own strong research and information skills, but they've developed skills in a whole range of different areas, in particular communication and presentation skills, because they do quite a lot of group training. Some have completed their PhDs and have successfully done so, which is fantastic. We had another one who completed his master's and now enrolled in a PhD. And, of course, we provide, obviously, a cycle of employment for HDR students at the university, which is fantastic. So the positions will continue into the future. We'll continue to employ HDR students in this role. It's certainly an evolving role. The strong focus this year was on developing our training that could better meet the needs of our off-campus students. So in particular, we've been trying to provide more flexible options both for off-campus and for on-campus students who can't always make it into the university. So the research support officers have been spending time with the research librarians redeveloping a program that was often based on a face-to-face delivery into more of an online delivery. Next year, their focus may be more strongly on supporting research data management. But the positions are flexible, allowing us to move people around to support needs as they occur. And it also helps us to keep that good connection with the faculties or with research centres based on a good understanding of what researchers' needs are, both as an individual and a research team level. And that's the main part of what I wanted to say today. Okay, thank you.
Our next speaker is Jenny Mitchell. Jennifer has worked at La Trobe University Library since 2010 as the Faculty Librarian for Health Sciences, and she's going to talk about LibRES, the Library Research Support Trial.
OK, Hi everyone, I'm Jenny. I'm presenting on behalf of a working group. There was a few of us involved in this project, and one of the other speakers, Kendra Watson's unwell, so she was unable to present today, unfortunately. But this project is an ongoing current project, so there's a lot of unanswered things. Okay, so I'll start with just giving an overview of the project. In 2011, there was an organisational structure change within the university, so that who we reported to, the library reporting line, actually changed. Previously, we reported to the DVC in education. And then partway through 2011, we moved across to be reporting to the DVC in research. So this meant there was a slight change in focus for the library, and we became much more focused on research support. Okay, so in 2012, there's an enhanced library research support service will be offered, and this is by our learning and research services area where our faculty librarians are located, and this is in order to contribute to the key objectives of the university's research plan 2012 to 2015. So this will be achieved by increasing the level of organisational support, assistance and advice, which will be available to our researchers, and also identifying some research training needs. Another part of an enhanced research support service is that there will be a new space being created at the Melbourne campus in the library called the Charles Latrobe Lounge. And this will be providing an extra increased meeting space and workspace for our senior alumni, for adjunct professors, for senior academic staff, and it's available for local and regional people. And it's also expected that this work will be finished perhaps at the end of this year. It's just starting now. But a key example of our increased research support has been implementation of the Library Research Support Trial, which we call LibRest. This project was designed to explore the feasibility of providing advanced research support across the faculty librarian group in learning and research services at La Trobe. Management recognised that the faculty librarians would need to have increased capacity to provide this increased service, and so we employed a library officer who allowed us faculty librarians to be freed up from the research help desk and from our LibChat service. We did an environmental scan at the beginning of this project just to see what other universities were doing and what sort of research support they were offering and what online forms they were using. And then we decided that we'd like to base our form on the University of Colorado in Denver because we thought their design fitted quite well with what we wanted to get from our form. So for the project, the group focused on how faculty librarians could contribute to the work of researchers within the Faculty of Health Sciences, and these include researchers and research assistants who would be perhaps conducting preliminary literature reviews or preparing grant applications or working on funded projects involving systematic literature reviews. We looked at providing a basic free course service that will be provided by the faculty librarians. Okay, so the trial explored using a standard framework for reporting literature searches, and that framework's called Starlight, and this is with the aim of developing a systematic, efficient and sustainable model for delivering those identified library services and also identifying potential opportunities for future research support services. Okay, so this is Andrew Booth's Starlight mnemonic, which can be used to convey the essential elements for reporting literature searches, and it's also based on a summary of different searching methods. So it's used to organise the requirements of the search, basically. So just to expand on that, Starlight is the beginning of the letters of each of the rows. So your S is for your sampling strategy, your T is for your type of study, A is approaches, R is your range of years, L's your limits, I's your inclusions and exclusions, your T's your terms used, and your E's your electronic sources. So we use this framework and we just sort of expanded upon it for our project. So for example, the sampling strategy part of the form would be asking things like it may be a comprehensive strategy they want us to use. The researcher might want us to actually look at all relevant studies on a topic, or they might want to be selective and ask us just to look at specific time periods, or they might ask to look at just specific journals. And say with the types of studies, they might like us to fully report on a particular study, type of study, or like a grounded theory or a design type, or they might just like us to partially report, so just like an umbrella category, so they might just ask us to look at the qualitative studies. So the process was, we had a working group that started in February this year, and it's still ongoing, we're still working on this. There were three faculty librarians working on it. Two of us were from health sciences, and the third one was from science, technology and engineering, and she was also our EndNote expert. And then there was a researcher working with us from the Faculty of Health Sciences, and the researcher provided us with our two test cases for our trial. Some things that the researcher brought up to us were things such were quite important, such as that a lot of the research assistants in the Faculty of Health Sciences don't have expert searching skills that we do as librarians, and that many of the actual researchers weren't aware of the help that we could provide them. So this is just a screenshot of our test cases for using the Starlight framework that we had for the Health Sciences faculty. So the first one was palliative care initiatives involving general practitioners, and the second one was to do with the use of telepresence in palliative care. So basically she filled in these fields based on that Starlight framework so we could get an idea of what sort of information she wanted us to find. We also used a group journal log for this trial. It was used to record the process of the trial and include all updates on the project, such as meeting dates, how long we met for, who attended, what was discussed, what actions we wanted to take, any decisions we made. And it was just a Word document that we stored on our group library drive so that we could all go in and put amendments in when we did things to do with the project. We thought it was important to have this log because it provided a reflection document of what worked and what needed to be changed. And by analysing the process, we realised that some changes were definitely necessary. An example of this was during the search process, we were providing sign and usernames and passwords for each database to the researcher so she could see what we had searched for. And it, after a while, it became quite messy. And so we decided that we would ideally like to just provide an EndNote file at the end of the process. Okay, so one important thing is we designed the web form that we wanted our researchers to complete. So this was designed based on that Starlight framework. So we were calling it a customised search service request form. And we went through and decided what sort of things we needed to ask on the form. Probably a bit hard to read, but I'll show you an example of the draft anyway. But we looked at sort of what questions we want to ask, and so we wanted to design the form so there wasn't a lot of going back and forth and to and fro with the researcher. At the very beginning, we wanted to get as much information as we could. And we also wanted to have the form that with an option that it would direct people that were using that weren't eligible for this service. So say if it was a student that was trying to book this service, we would actually direct them to where they should be actually an appropriate part of the website. So a postgraduate student might be redirected to our book or consultation with a faculty librarian rather than this research grant funding support service. And we decided also when we were designing this form that there needed to be an area where we drew the line at what part of services we could provide. We didn't want to be doing the work of the research assistant, so we didn't want to have questions that might lead them to thinking we'd be doing hand searching. So this is our first draft of the request form, only just done this week, and it hasn't been sort of put through the whole groups and there hasn't been feedback about it. But basically the design is that the step one, it will be like a four-step process on the form because there are a lot of questions we want to ask so that we're not going back to the researcher with emails and phone calls all the time asking what do you really mean and what do you need. So this part will just ask basically general information, including what faculty they belong to, and they might even tick a few fields here if there's a working group across different faculties. We actually took our template to our online communications and learning team, and so it's only really gone to a small group of people. It hasn't gone through our whole faculty librarian group yet. We're having a special research meeting in June, or mid this month, and we'll then be getting more feedback from the other faculty librarians of perhaps other fields that they think's required. So step two of the form will just be to do the literature review. So we'll ask questions like on the form, such as the search terms, the databases they want us to look in, any relevant journals they might like us to look into. And then step three is additional information. So this will be things like the type of publication and the age group. There is a mistake on this form. Does anyone spot it? You're awake? Yeah, population group's got journal articles in it. So as I said, this is raw. This is just the first draft. You know, we just sort of basically whipped it out this week, and we'll be going back and amending it, of course, but also adding any fields that other librarians might decide are appropriate for their faculty area. The fourth part of the form will just be the confirmation and submission part of the form, so I haven't got a screenshot of that yet because that part hasn't been done. So the report back form, for the trial we actually did a few different things which I said we decided we would change. One was we used the Starlight template form with additional information. So we also inserted in the form the subject terms and subject headings that we were using. We included some screenshots of the search histories, which did have limitations because it meant then the researcher had to go back and repeat the search herself manually. It wasn't a live document, just screenshots. And the accounts that we created also got very messy when people were going in and amending and forgetting the passwords. And the EndNote file, we also did an EndNote file and we attached that to an email. So the next steps, because this is still very much the beginning stage, we decided we needed to better design a report back form using that Starlight framework, but with an EndNote file, and we also wanted to give the option of a Word document that they could have, because we're aware a lot of researchers mightn't be very confident using EndNote, so they could also have the Word document format. And ideally, it would be an online creation that would be based on the original form, so also making less work for us as librarians, not having to copy and paste things, just being able to fill in like maybe another comments box on the original form where we put in all our extra information. And we just basically want to make sure it's a streamlined process. Once the final version of the customised service request form has been approved, the library will then trial it with our Faculty of Health Sciences again, and then we'll actually transfer that across to other discipline areas so that we'll go across to our business area and our humanities. We're also going to consider offering different levels of service. So this is a basic core service. We might offer a premium service later on, which would be perhaps funded by each department, and it might be that we might get to the level of actually doing data analysis, depending on what demand is and where we decide to go with it. We'd like to identify that there's extra training might be required, so perhaps refreshers on EndNote for those faculty librarians that don't feel confident with it. And we also might need to look at some restrictions that we might need to impose based on maybe maximum number of requests, because in case we get swamped, and especially we're looking at maybe limiting at certain times of the year when we won't be able to offer this service, so perhaps the first busy teaching period of the semester, because we're aware of the time. We need to assess how the faculty librarians can work on systematic reviews uninterrupted, because it isn't very inefficient if you start it and then stop and go and do a desk shift and then do a consultation and then come back and go, what was I doing again? So we really want to try and work out how we can allow time for faculty librarians to actually work on that uninterrupted. But basically this customised form and service, based on the framework, the Starlight framework, it will hopefully be used to streamline this research support service that we're offering, and it will be utilised because we're expecting demand to increase once the word spreads that we're offering this service, and we want to make sure that our learning and research services area offer a good streamlined service that is sustainable too. Okay, that was my presentation. Thank you. I've got a question.
Oh, yeah. Great. As the slide says, we've got time for questions now. I think we've got about 10 minutes. So I'll ask our three speakers to come back up, and I'll throw it open to you to...
Yes, they are. They're actually paid at Hugh 5 level, which is, we learnt probably a little bit after we'd locked into that that's possibly a bit too high, but we've stuck with it. I guess the thing is that we're requiring them to be a graduate, and when we sort of first went through, they're casual positions, So the position description didn't have to go through any big hoops. It just that was sort of the figure we arrived at. In moving forward in sort of severe budgetary times, that still might get revised. It's just difficult once we started. We'd advertised a year ago at that level and then learnt that the counterparts in Edith Cowan were paid considerably less. So I'm not sure about the research support officers. They are Hugh 5 as well, yeah. There's EFT, there's I think 500 or 600 research students. It's actually closer to 800 or 900 individuals. But they're also servicing staff, although obviously there's fewer staff that kind of have a call on it. But yeah, so I mean there's a, what is there, somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000. I'm actually not sure of the figures of academic staff at the CUNY at the moment, but if you didn't hear that, there's about 400 research active staff, but particularly it's the early career researchers that are probably going to more likely make use of it. I'll just say one thing about the salary in realising that we could have probably discounted it slightly because of, there's such a professional development for them. There's a benefit for them as well as them providing a service. And we'd originally looked at it more in terms of them being, we didn't want to exploit them, but yeah. So if you're considering doing something, you need to weigh that up as to whether it's valued at a Hugh 5 level or slightly discounted for the fact that they're getting benefit from it.
That's right, that's what we're sort of, we're aware that it could explode, and that's when we sort of said maybe there will be those restrictions on how many we can provide, because at the moment we're getting those sort of queries but in a more casual way. We just get them direct through email. We're not actually documenting it in a format like this form, so there is potential that it could go huge, and then we'd have to perhaps review, or maybe we can only offer so much at certain times of the year. Yeah, so we are definitely aware. But it also provides us, this format would also let us see that there's actually a uniform service provided. At the moment, inquiries can come from different faculties to different librarians, and it's a bit hard to know if we're giving an equal service across all the different disciplines. And also, it's for reporting to management, or even management reporting to the university. It would make it a clearer process of how much work we're doing with research with support.
We're using eLive, Illuminate Live. We've been using Illuminate Live for a number of years, but when we first negotiated with the Institute for Research Training to be part of a much more formal program of university-wide research support, the director of the Institute was relatively new to the university, and to get the program up and running initially in 2009, he had a stronger focus on in-person training. But it's obvious that, you know, you need to be able to provide flexibility for on-campus students and meet the needs of your off-campus better. And, of course, Deakin does have a high off-campus student profile. So while we've been working with eLive over a number of years, and we had been running sessions that way, the more formal program initially started as much more of an in-person. So we've been pushing the Institute and encouraging a stronger focus on using technology. So eLive is what we've been using at the moment, and LEAs and librarians use it in a number. People talk about using Skype, and it's being used on a one-to-one basis. It's not nearly as good in terms of the ability to share the desktop and so on, the ability to have a number of people connected in at once. So that's what we're using just at the moment, yeah. Uh, Yes. Yosuke can probably speak a little bit more about this than me, but I'll address it. The program was originally developed, but no program stays the same. So, you know, as you deliver it, you learn that there are better ways of doing things and there's content that's better suited to people's needs and so on. So every year and every time we run it, we will make some changes to it. Some are more significant changes than others. In 2009, when the research support officers first started, and Jenny commented upon the need for training, and it was quite high level, the kind of training that was provided, we gradually, as we've recruited new research support officers into the role, have looked for those who've had a slightly higher level of library expertise and some training expertise as well. So as part of the recruitment process, they'd be required to do a presentation. So that we're not having to provide quite as much training as we might have in the first stages of the program, which means that their skill level at developing and delivering content is probably stronger than it might have been initially. So they certainly play a much stronger role now in developing the content, and they're actively involved in evaluation. And like everyone else, we're using SurveyMonkey, doing pre and post self-assessment of learning at a higher degree level. We're certainly not pre and post testing. The students are simply asked prior to attending the session what their level of skills and familiarity are, and then after attending the session a little bit later on, they're asked to make another assessment. So it's certainly not an actual assessment of learning outcomes in that stronger sense of the word, but it gives us a good indication. What it's done is probably provided a better opportunity for targeted support, so less of the one-to-one, we certainly provide one-to-one support, but less of the constant kind of one-to-one ad hoc, I'll just run a training for this particular group. The liaison librarians are actively involved in the training program though, so they also, with the research support officers and the research librarians, deliver some of that content as well. So in a way, It's hard to quantify, but what it's done is actually provide an opportunity for more targeted support. We know that we're part of a university-wide initiative and program, so it's likely that that kind of program will be what will continue into the future.
It would. I think we're still establishing that, actually. I think it would be anybody that's working on funded, like a grant proposal or a funded thing. It couldn't just be a student that wants that service. I think we're targeting more at staff at this stage, but, I mean, it's still, we haven't seen how much demand there'll be to see whether it would be expanded across to, you know, the general population and doing systemic risk, but I think it would be more staff and researchers and working on funded projects.
Well, their role in particular, the research support officers, was to promote the research repository and to promote messages about open access. In preparation for 2010 and 2012, they did talk to academics, but it wasn't their role specifically to source documents and to make those accessible. Our digital services team were the ones who obtained some of that content, but a lot of it actually comes via the HERDSEA reporting process directly through the faculties. So it makes its way via a faculty process, then across into Deakin Research Online. In terms of obtaining postprints for open access, though, certainly the DRO team, the Deakin Research Online team, do a lot of that promotion. Liaison librarians play a role in that as well. So the research support officers, they support that, but it's not their sole responsibility. But clearly, they know how to talk about the repository. They know how to promote the open access message. They know how to make a referral from an interested academic through to the right person who can help them to get those documents and get them into the repository.
And I could say it's similar, but possibly a little bit less emphasis. The ambassadors certainly have been through training in sort of where to publish and measuring research impact kind of agenda, and so very aware of open access, but it's certainly not something that sort of particularly pushed. I think our focus has actually been on the data management side. If they're having conversation with a researcher to talk about their data rather than open access, it's more part of my role in the training I do around where to publish and promoting open access that it's pushed. So I wouldn't say it's their role, only in a very small awareness. And our method of getting full text into our repository, again, it's linked to the HERDSI reporting. But the main thing is we push the message out that if you want to make sure your full text is in the repository, you approach us. So the citation data's in there. I'm not sure if that's the model that you've got. And so it's just from various workshops that I attend. So I don't think the research ambassadors are playing a big part in that at this point.
So we're right on time, so we'll break for afternoon tea and come back at 3:30. Jackie, but you are. Oh, sorry.